From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's how State Senate President Wayne Niederhauser described the negotiations between Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, and lawmakers over a plan to deal with homeless people. He said it was like keeping jackrabbits on a flatbed truck. The House Speaker Greg Hughes said for a while the negotiations were miserable, his word. Well, last Friday, they had finally managed to work out a plan, a new plan, a new model. Gone was the controversial idea of 4 shelters in Salt Lake City. Sugar House residents had been particularly vocal in opposition to a designated site on Simpson Avenue. Now there are going to be just 2 shelters in the city, 1 more in the county. And as for the Road Home shelter in downtown, that's going to close. They have a hard closing date of June 2019. Today in the program, we're talking about this new plan and what happened to the old one. Join us after the news.
Hey, it's Tim Slover from KUER. You like podcasts, right? I do. So this month, we're asking you to tell someone about a podcast you think they'll love. That could be your mom or a friend or, I don't know, someone who doesn't really get podcasts yet, anybody. You can pick whatever podcast you want. Maybe it's about music or politics, maybe cooking or Stranger Things fan theories or rodeo clowning or meditation. Just get a friend to listen. Remember to hit the share button and use the hashtag tripod. That's try with a Y followed by pod because of jokes. And thanks for getting the word out.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, this issue of what to do with and about the homeless population in Salt Lake County is about more than just Simpson Avenue. That was, of course, the site of one of the 4 150-bed shelters proposed in this plan for minimizing homelessness in Utah. So it's about more than Simpson Avenue, but that site came to be kind of the epicenter for this issue. As residents of the neighborhood and Sugar House in general protested, they packed hearings, they wrote op-ed pieces, sent emails, Facebook posts. When state and local leaders announced last Friday they had ditched the Simpson Avenue part of the plan, they said it had not been motivated, in fact, by that public outrage, that there were other practical decisions they took into account. Well, today in the program, we're talking about this new plan announced late last week, a plan away from 4 shelters in the city to 2 now, 1 more in the county. The new plan also calls for a hard closure date for the Road Home shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. So we're talking about that old plan and about the new one today. And Matthew Piper is joining us. He's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering this issue. And Matthew Piper, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to let's just basically go over some quick basics. There was a plan unveiled in the fall, of course. 4 homeless shelters in Salt Lake City. These were 150 beds in each. And it was tied to this phase out of the Road Home shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. Say something about the old plan. I mean, the idea is they wanted to come up with a sort of a broad, encompassing resource plan to deal with this issue.
Right. And of course, that was a revision to a previous plan to have 2 shelters with 250 beds each. And this is kind of in the weeds, maybe, but also no hard cap on the size of those shelters. So city council members feared some communities might be getting 300 or 400-bed homeless shelters. So what the city council argued for was to have 4 sites, right, with 150 beds, lessen the impact on the affected communities. And they won a sort of victory at the end of September in getting the mayor and the county and state to go along with that.
So in many ways, this new plan announced late last week is kind of phase 3.
Correct, yeah.
It's been through a number of iterations, yeah. What happened to phase 2, the Simpson Avenue thing, basically? When did things start to turn? I mentioned the Simpson Avenue thing, and it seems to be the thing that comes to people's mind right away because for various reasons. I mean, it is a site in a neighborhood, and, of course, packed hearings. All of that was very – I mean, the optics of that were pretty clear. What happened? I mean, basically, we'll sort of break this down, but when did it start to turn, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting comment that officials have made that the Simpson Avenue opposition didn't really have anything to do with this because That is what we've seen now for 2 months, is public hearing sessions that are just packed with residents looking to get their 2 minutes worth of feedback in. Almost all of it about the Simpson site, very little about the other three sites. And the Simpson site has been sort of plagued by, had been, I should say, sort of plagued by problems, right? I mean, the $7 million price tag was much, much more than County Mayor Ben McAdams said he was expecting the city to pay and then expect to be reimbursed for out of state money. You know, I think the residents made some points that resonated at least with their city council member, and Lisa Adams, who put forth the idea of maybe just withdrawing that site and getting by with three.
Right.
And then McAdams kind of jumped on that idea. I guess I can't say for sure who had the idea first, but what Ben said was, we have a shelter in Midvale that's serving families right now.
Right.
And the way that Simpson Avenue site had been sold to residents is, don't worry, it's going to be low impact, family, homeless population. And the reason that your community is so perfect for them is because this neighborhood will help them assimilate back into.
They'll be part of the community.
Right.
Yeah.
And so once Ben came out and said, you know, I think that the Midvale shelter with 300 beds that's currently serving shelter or serving families will do the trick. That kind of called into question the economies of scale of having four shelters and having one that might not be necessary for that population. And this is at least the way it has been portrayed by state and local leaders, that when they started looking at the numbers, they realized that they could do this for cheaper if they had only three sites. That meant that they'd have to have more beds at each site.
Yeah.
And what House Speaker Greg Hughes says is it would have been unfair to go back to Salt Lake City after their council members had fought for 150-bed limits to ask them to take on three 200-bed shelters. So the concession there was kind of made by Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams to take one of those sites in the county. And now we have, again, what is being billed as a united front between all sides.
It seemed to get pretty ugly for a while there, fairly contentious. I'm not sure how much you were privy to. But House Speaker, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, House Speaker Greg Hughes called the process miserable. How much influence did the legislature have on all of this? Can you tell?
I think they had a pretty strong influence. And there is sort of a funny irony in Greg getting to sort of wrangle the state's most high-powered Democrats here, right? I'm sure this may have been a real headache, but he comes out looking pretty good. Which is not to say that he and everybody here don't have the best of intentions, but it is sort of a funny image anyway. I think that, you know, Greg Hughes certainly impressed upon city leaders that there was a real hard timeline back in September,
right,
and that led to that deal. I think all along the city and county have been trying to not rush, but to move expeditiously so that the legislature can see that they're making progress. They're fighting against a lot of other worthy causes for funding. And Greg has said, look, I don't want to see all this work be for nothing. So I think that pressure and the $27 million at the state has sort of a handshake promise to this collaboration is very, very important.
One of the big questions, and I think it remains a big question, is when to close or if to close completely the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. There's been an impasse about whether you phase it out, you set a hard date. They've come, as you mentioned earlier, they've come to a hard closure date, June 30th, I think it is, 2019. Is that settled then, or is that still up in the air, do you think, in some ways?
Nothing's really binding ever, right?
Yeah.
I think it's settled to the degree that it resolves the argument that's been happening in the public, which was always sort of, I think, always left the state leaders scratching their heads a little bit. Why do we need to argue about this fine point at this stage, years away from when we were talking about the phase out or closure of the Road Home Shelter?
Right.
I think, you know, it's very important to Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, and this is me saying I think this is the case, that she have a deadline that gets people moving. If she doesn't commit to a hard deadline, if she can't get all sides to say they agree to close the road home, then the road home becomes this sort of safety net. And then if the service model doesn't work, they talk about leaving the road home open a little bit longer. Yeah. And, you know, next thing you know, Salt Lake City has 5 shelters, this on the old forest shelter model, and 2 in close proximity to each other. And the whole sort of problem that led to this effort in the first place, which is sort of the lawlessness and the undeniability of the problem at Rio Grande, remains.
Yeah. Of course, homeless advocates, we'll hear from one, Glenn Bailey, later. They're not crazy about the idea of closing it, of putting a hard closure date on it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the numbers, as many people have said throughout this, the numbers can puzzle you. You're looking at going from an 1,100 capacity shelter to 4 shelters, or now 3 shelters that would have 600 total beds. And
that's,
you know,
a net loss of a lot of beds.
It's a net loss of a lot of beds. And the point that I think city and county leaders are straining to make is, you know, those beds are going to be represented through affordable housing, permanent housing, permanent supportive housing in some cases, treatment beds that will break the cycle for some of these people. I think that, you know, they have really struggled to make that argument, because what people see is a nationwide crisis. And, you know, I think there are some people who have a bleak view of the future right now as well. So all that together makes it a real hard sell.
So I'm going to come back to this question of Simpson Avenue right now. How much influence can you say, I guess it's hard to say, how much influence was the public outcry from Sugar House citizens in the neighborhood, the neighbors in Simpson Avenue, in the decision to change the plan? What do you see as the takeaway from that? On many ways, you can say, hey, look, grassroots citizen activism made a difference. These guys got involved, they got organized, and they seemed to change a policy or affected the outcome in some ways. And then the counterview of that, of course, is, okay, if you don't want a project in your backyard, the whole not in my backyard thing, then you just make a big stink and the other neighbors will have to take it on somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you make of that part of this story?
Yeah, I mean, at a minimum, I guess if we qualify what they accomplished, the very minimum is they influenced Councilwoman Lisa Adams to be among the first to propose these alternatives.
Right.
So I do believe they had an influence here. I think, you know, having heard so many hours of their testimony, it's clear that they're making some very legitimate points. The NIMBY criticism is, everywhere.
Yeah.
During all of these types of situations. And I think it's hard for them, for these opponents of the Simpson Avenue site, to see that written about themselves when they invested, you know, a lot of money, in some cases most of their money, into single-family homes in that neighborhood, thinking that they were living the American dream. And to be fair, it is kind of unique among the 4 sites that were chosen. The others don't abut neighborhoods.
Right.
The others, don't have commercial tenants that are hugely popular, like the daycare at Simpson Avenue. And so I think they made some points that were hard to deny, at least. And whether or not this is this provides impetus for future engagements, I guess, remains to be seen. But probably, yeah.
But that's the question: what kind of precedent does something like this set? Again, citizen activists going for it and making a difference, and then next time there's something that officials say is in the public interest, we'll just go for the neighborhood that causes the least amount of stink. Do you know what I mean? I wonder what kind of precedent this, and if you think concerns about that by Mayor McAdams, which we'll ask, or Mayor Biskupski, or any state officials, they didn't come right out and say it had any impact at all, because they were worried about the precedent it might set. Any sense of that?
I guess I can't speak to whether, you know, in future situations that this will set a precedent. What I will say, though, is it's certainly changed the way that these leaders are talking about a public process. And now in Mayor McAdams' siting decision, he's saying We're going to bring forth some candidates to the public to be vetted by the public through the public process.
Because that was a big problem, at least from the perspective of some, that it wasn't as a transparent process.
Right. Yeah. And so that, of course, that's going to do nothing to stop this from happening, but it will at least save leaders maybe the political black eye that they took in this case, because they will be able to make a decision having heard that comment. And you know, I guess we will see. You know, Biskupski has said she didn't want to pit neighborhood against neighborhood. Critics have said she wound up doing that anyway. There's no avoiding that. I guess we'll see now with the county's decision, you know, who's right.
Finally, any sense of how much political damage this may have caused Mayor Biskupski?
I mean, she certainly took it on the chin for the sighting decision. And, you know, I think she won the Society of Professional Journalists Black Hole Award here for lack of transparency. And that's a tough one for her because she campaigned on transparency. I mean, that has been at the core of her message, was that she was going to collaborate and reach out to the community. And, you know, for one issue, really, she's got a reputation now of being a closed door dealer. And so I think it's a pretty serious hit, but it is year one of a 4-year term, and you know, this will be judged years from now as far as the importance goes for her reelection, and I think she has some time to recover and see how this plays out.
It's Matthew Piper, reporter covering Salt Lake City for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing the latest in this ongoing debate over how to deal with homeless people in the Salt Lake Valley. There had been a plan in place. There have been two plans now. We ended up with 4 resource centers in Salt Lake City. Eventually, the idea was to replace the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. Sugar House residents, among others, have been protesting that plan. In particular, one of the sites planned for Simpson Avenue. Now officials have changed the plan. We're on iteration number 3. There will be just 2 centers rather than 4 in the city, another one in the county. We're talking about what happened today, actually, and how this new resource plan is supposed to deal with all of these problems. Joining us now is Gary Real. He's the founder of SLC Residents for Transparency and Representation. It's a group from the Sugar House area, around the Simpson Avenue area. And Gary Real, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How much difference do you figure you made on the process? They changed last Friday. And they said, look, we were not motivated by all these protests. We get that they were upset, but there were other reasons. Do you buy it?
Yeah, I think the price tag was probably the biggest factor for them.
The land, the $7 million mm-hmm. for Simpson in particular?
Yeah, and the fact that they had to buy several parcels that they didn't really even want. And I think that on a state level, the people who are funding this were less happy about that. And we, you know, kept them and kept as many people as we could aware of how this didn't add up. And there were many things about it that just didn't add up.
So wait, what role? Pardon me. What role do you figure you played? That all of this activism, Chris Sieven, I think that's how it's pronounced. He's the leader of a group opposed to the Simpson site as well, and he said that if you guys had not made as much noise as you did, there is no way the plan would have been changed. There's the idea of the practical concerns and the merits. There's the idea of just the citizen activism. What part do you figure you played in all of that?
Well, I think we're still playing a part. And it started out as, oh, we're getting this site right here, 75 feet from Chris's house. And we've got, you know, cherished local-owned businesses all along that street right there, on that little area, and they were going to just demolish all of them. And so that's kind of how it started. But we became really well-informed, reading a lot of expert opinions, listening to the people who had stuff to say about it. A lot of people thought this was a really bad plan. One expert said it was the second worst plan he'd seen in the nation. And so we became informed, educated about it. And while the site at Simpson is still not there, I think that most of us are still active and are still advocating. We want a plan. We need a plan that works. We need a plan that has a future, that has a 5-year and a 7-year. We need a plan that has predictable results right
now. You don't see that in this new plan?
I don't see that, no.
Why?
We don't really have any model for a scattered, sheltered, housing first kind of site. That is, it's an experiment. It's a philosophy.
And the philosophy is, as you see it, we'll provide treatment, we'll provide rehabilitation measures, and in the end, that will lessen the number. But you don't think that, you're worried that that's too experimental.
I think that the thing that they are ignoring in this plan is that there's going to be a number of people who, A, don't want treatment, or B, don't make it through. And
what happens if that doesn't work?
Where do those guys go?
Yeah.
So friends of mine live near High Street, and they say, you know, they're really in favor of this. And then as I'm talking to them, and they say the thing that concerns them, well, when somebody says, I'm sorry, you're out of the program, you failed, or, you know, you didn't get clean, whatever, where do they go? You don't take them to another house. They don't have a home. So now where do these people go? They go in your neighborhood.
Does Sugar House need a homeless shelter?
No. We were trying to advocate for, there's a location. Mayor Biskupski was part of helping clean up a car wash that was on 21st South, I'm not sure, 7th, 8th East or so.
Yeah.
And there were a few people in our coalition that they were saying, okay, what about there instead? There's nothing there. We're not displacing a local business. It's further away from people. There were a lot of people that were advocating for that the old Deseret Industries. Now, the city said, no, that's too close to a liquor store, which was laughable to us because we're the street, the location on Simpson was one track train stop away from the liquor store. But
you know the argument, right? It's that, okay, here are a bunch of neighbors upset that it's going to ruin their property values, that not in my backyard stuff. You heard a lot of that.
A lot.
And now there's a precedent. Some people are a little concerned that there's a precedent that, hey, you guys got your act together. And you stirred it up, and now what happens to the real practical reasons for citing place? Sometimes these places are going to have to go in places where people don't want them. I mean, how do you respond to that? Because as you say, as you acknowledge, you heard that a lot, the idea of not in my backyard.
Certainly, and we're still hearing it a lot. But yeah. But when we came to meetings and when we were writing emails and while we're chatting with each other, it wasn't just NIMBY conversations. It wasn't just a not in my backyard conversation. It wasn't just about the housing values. That was part of it.
Sure.
But that wasn't all that we were talking about. We were talking about the plan. We were talking about how on Monday, Mayor Biskupski says, well, we're just going to arrest anybody that's hanging out around there in the new shelters. And then the next day, KSL comes out with an article where they say, we can't throw people who are committing crimes in jail right now, because the jail just turns them away. They don't have room. Okay, so now those people. So on day one, she says something, and on day two, she says something else. And we're still seeing that. On the city website, it said everybody was in agreement that the Simpson site, capped at 100 people, was a good plan. Well, not everybody was in agreement with that. And that was the first time any of us had heard capped at 100. So I just feel like we lost a lot of trust in Mayor Biskupski, and she never tried to regain it. She always tried to frame the conversation that we were having with her as NIMBY. But we had a lot of other concerns that were not just my backyard concerns, and we still have those concerns, and we're still active because of it.
That gets at, I think, my last question, and that is, now, do you think you can rebuild some sort of trust with the mayor now?
I doubt it. I think that at this point we're looking forward to someone qualified to run against her.
But let's say the broader plan works. Even though you're skeptical of it, there are a lot of people who are skeptical of it, that if you are able to impose more holistic approaches to homelessness, that will decrease numbers. If you see this particular plan starting to work, would you think differently about the mayor?
No. I think my issues with the mayor are not just related to this situation. My issues with the mayor are the way that she wanted to have the conversation or refused to have any conversation, didn't show up to meetings, didn't participate in things that we tried to get information, didn't respond. When she did respond, or whoever her representative is responding on Facebook, we would get comments like, it seems that you lack compassion, as we're presenting evidence and we're saying, here's all this information. This is more than just NIMBY. She just wouldn't have any of it. And she continued and still continues. If you look at the thing written yesterday about it, she continues to kind of jab at the Sugar House area. Oh, these were our bad neighbors. You know, that West Sugar House, where the poor people of Sugar House are, the working class people. So my issues with her have to do with the lack of transparency, the Black Hole Award. My issues with her have to do with the way that she refused to communicate. My issues with her are about a lot more than just the homeless situation.
That's Gary Real, founder of the neighborhood organizing group SLC Residents for Transparency and Representation, joined us here in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you,
Appreciate
Doug.
That. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the latest in this ongoing debate. It really is an ongoing debate over how you deal with homeless people in Salt Lake Valley. There have been a number of plans in place. By my count, three iterations now of a plan. Began with a certain number of resource centers, was paired to four resource centers in Salt Lake City. Now, late last week, state and city and county leaders mentioned the latest plan. Two now. City resource centers in the city, in Salt Lake City, one in the county. And the idea also, which is somewhat controversial, to set a hard date for a closure of the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. So we've been talking about all the machinations of all of this. We're joined now by the mayor of Salt Lake County, Mayor Ben McAdams. And Mayor, welcome back to you. Thanks for
being
with us.
Great to be back, Doug.
And Glenn Bailey is with us. He's the executive director of the Crossroads Urban Center. That's, for those who don't know, a nonprofit organization that assists and organizes Utahns with low incomes, those with disabilities, and people of color as well. And Glenn Bailey, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Mayor McAdams, I want to begin with you. And what seems like, can you say, in fact, what do you say to the people who are skeptical of the idea that, in fact, all of those people who are organizing in Simpson Avenue and the Sugar House area didn't, in fact, influence the process? Can you say that?
Well, a lot of things influence the process. And the first thing I would say is that's okay. You know, we're elected to listen to the public. We have to make decisions that are based on data that, as we're trying to understand a very complicated challenge, we want to, and our understanding grows the deeper we get into this. And the public input is part of it. I think it's not a bad thing to say we're listening to the public and trying to make informed decisions. Now,
No, it's not. But that's not what apparently you said. I mean, apparently what you said was, well, it didn't really motivate the process.
Well, I think what I would say didn't motivate the process is the NIMBY, not in my backyard, is not a reason that we're going to change. We need to make well-informed decisions. We're going to learn things from the public. We're going to change our minds based on what we learn. But wherever you put one of these facilities, there's going to be somebody that says, I don't want it close to me. And we can't – that's not information that we can factor into our decisions.
You – we'll dig into this a little bit later. It was said, I don't know how much you can disclose of what happened in those negotiations. I know they weren't always easy. In the end, you, I guess, gave way on the question of this hard closure date for the road home. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't. I conceded that we will look to close the road home. I think it's because new things came to the table. Some of the things that we're talking about now. I early on said that you can't replace 1,100 beds with 600 beds and a hope and a prayer and think it's going to be okay. We need something. This equation needs to balance, and it didn't balance when that's all that was on the table. So we brought forward other factors in this, in addition to the shelter, that in my assessment will make that equation balance now.
How do you make the Glenn, I'm going to get you here in a moment, but I want to sort of lay some groundwork here. Mayor, how do you deal with that discrepancy then? Because this is sort of the crux of your larger, more holistic plan.
And I did not feel in good conscience that we could, you know, leave people high and dry and turn them to the street. But also, I know that'll cause chaos on the streets of Salt Lake City. If the equation doesn't balance and we just hope it'll work out, that's utter chaos and not something that we want to deal with. And as we saw, I think with other components, somebody's going to be left holding the bag on that. And I think that's probably Salt Lake County. So we said we need to act responsibly. We need to know that there's a concrete plan. So it really, when I say equation, it probably is almost a pretty good term, because we looked at the numbers. There are 1,100 beds at the Rio Grande shelter, and you're going to replace it with 600 beds. Where do the other 500 people go? So we started looking at things like an overflow shelter during the winter months and vouchers. If there's an excess in demand, or we have vouchers to put some of our people into motels, what treatment options are going to be available to get people into treatment? And so those are some of the other pieces that came together that are still being hammered out through the legislative process, but it is those treatment beds and overflow beds and other things that when we finally looked at the spreadsheet, it added up to 1,100. And
you've heard people who are nervous about that this is a noble gesture. I think everyone agrees would like a plan like that to work.
Yeah.
But what if it doesn't? It's an experiment, and what if it doesn't? And now you guys have a whole hard closure date for June 30th, and it seems like you can't go back on that.
I don't think it's fair to call it an experiment. I think, you know, everything we're doing, the pieces of this exist either here in Salt Lake County, it exists around the country. So what we're doing, we know will work. There's room for the new model to.
So it's worked before.
It's worked before. I think there's some contingencies built in. One of the key pieces for me was this concept of an overflow. If it's not working, if there's a margin of people who aren't being served by this, that we have a low barrier overflow shelter is the necessary piece that helped that equation to balance at the end of the day. That if the resource centers, you know, we know these resource centers will work better than just a low barrier shelter to connect people to treatment and get them better. At what numbers? If is it working at, you know, and it's not going to be 100% of the people who are going to be served by that. Is it 30%? But what happens if 30% becomes 25%? Where do you make up that difference? And so that's what I'm comfortable is it's addressed now in the new plan that there's contingencies, be it overflow shelter, be it some of the motel vouchers or other things, that there are contingencies built into the new plan to where I got comfortable that it was responsible, the equation balanced, and that we can responsibly say we can close the Rio Grande shelter.
Glenn Bailey, let me ask you, before we dig into your concerns about the hard closure date of Rio, for example, the Rio Grande location, general reaction to the plan announced last Friday?
I guess I was disappointed in a lot of ways. I mean, I think that we definitely need new shelter, and I appreciate the work of Mayor McAdams and others spending political capital to deal with this really, really tough issue. But I don't feel that the plan as presented so far is adequate. I think there's a lot of questions. I really am concerned about a hard closure date that's based on an unproven model at a time when homelessness is increasing and is a crisis in every American city. I think we need a more adequate response, and I have a lot of concerns that this just doesn't cover all the bases.
Let's come back to that, because I want you both to maybe engage in that question. What did you make of the influence, I guess, the impact of the Sugar House citizens on this process? What did you think about that? I mean, the question that we asked earlier of Gary Reel was, do you need a homeless shelter in Sugar House? And he said no.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I did hear him say that. I think what we need is low barrier shelter downtown. for people who aren't going to fit into the model or haven't yet fit into the new model.
Glenn, will you explain what that means, low barrier?
That means a place where you can, if you're outside and you need a place to sleep for the night, you can get in without jumping through any hoops. We're going to give you a bed, and whether you move through a process or get into a shelter where you're going to be caseworked, it doesn't matter. We're going to give you a place to sleep for the night, some place that just doesn't have a lot of hoops to jump through. That's what we have now. And I think you have to have that downtown because that's where people are going to be, regardless of where you locate your new resource centers. The problem with Sugar House is that there's an increasingly visible homeless population in Sugar House. Anybody who lives or works there will tell you that. And they really do need a shelter. They probably didn't need a family shelter. They probably need a low-barrier shelter. Sugar House is our second downtown, in essence. So I would disagree that they don't need a shelter. As far as the fight over that particular location, I didn't pay a lot of attention to that. What I'm really paying attention to is, are we putting low-barrier shelter in the right place, and do we have enough beds overall in the system to give the new model a chance to function?
What's the new model, Mayor, based on? Here's the way it was put earlier. You said the primary way to access Utah's homeless service system is through a crisis and arrival at an emergency shelter. It seems like that is the crux of the problem, or one of them for you.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, we want to reorient the system right now. What we did early on in this process is I call it the mapping of the genome of homeless services, where we understand where the funding's coming from, be it government funding or private or philanthropic faith-based funding, and then where that funding goes. And then we trace the course of people coming through the system. And we identified some strengths, but we also identified some weaknesses. One of the weaknesses is we see that really the way to access homeless services is through the shelter. So you have somebody who's in crisis. Maybe they lost their job and they're about to be evicted from their home. And what we're telling them is give up your home, come to the shelter, and then we can help you. When it might be cheaper, better for the individual, cheaper for the taxpayer to say, here's a rental voucher to help you get through the month or to stay in your housing for a few more weeks. So we saw that this bottleneck in the Rio Grande that was both systematic but physical. People are aggregating outside the shelter because that is the place that you queue for all of our homeless services. And so part of the redesign is to say we want to meet people where they are. There are indicators out there where we can see people who are in crisis and about to become homeless, and let's get them resources earlier, which is oftentimes going to be smaller resources and for a shorter period of time, and stabilize them in place. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at with the overhaul of the system entirely is to say we're going to look at diversion from homelessness, prevention of homelessness, reaching out through the school system, other places to keep people stable before they need shelter. Once they're in shelter, the focus is going to be connecting them to those services that can get them stabilized as quickly as possible. The analogy I often give is think of a homeless shelter, an emergency shelter like an emergency room. If that emergency room is the only place where you can access health care, and you have to stay there until you're healthy and ready to leave, that's a really expensive model and oftentimes not very effective. When you just have generalists, you don't have specialists who can come in and treat the underlying cause. And so what we want is an emergency shelter system that is more emergency, that you come and you stay there until you can get connected to other resources. And we focus on shortening the duration of people who are staying in shelter by increasing the throughput. We're connecting them to services, be it treatment or workforce training or other services that are going to help them get out of shelter and get them stabilized. So shelter is just a temporary landing place, not a long-term landing place.
What percentage, and Glenn, I want to hear you on this point, what percentage of the homeless want that help?
I think many of them do. I think when you look at
Any idea of what percentage?
Yeah, I don't have them off the top of my head, but we do have those numbers. So you look at the number of people who stay in shelter for months versus the number of people who stay in shelter for days or weeks. And by and large, the majority of our homeless population are in shelter for days or weeks or maybe a month or two. The majority of our homeless beds are used by people who are using those beds for 3 to 9 months to 12 months a year. So those are we have a lot of resources being used by very few people. So it's the focus on those who are using long term and helping them get connected to services. And then we may have, that bed could be used, that bed that's serving one person for a year can serve 12 people for a month. So we can increase the efficiency of how our emergency resources are used.
Glenn, Billy, how do you see that? It seems like there's this myth about the homeless that they're mostly mentally ill people who, if you offered them the greatest services in the world, they wouldn't be interested in it because they're not in the place to really take it?
Well, I don't think that's true by and large. I do think that there are certainly individuals who don't want to participate in something like this. Absolutely. But what I see on the street right now is a lot of hopelessness, where people don't feel that they're ever going to get off the street. And so why bother? Why go through these changes? Why go through a new system? Why work with a caseworker? All of it. The only thing I've ever really seen that works well is housing first. So in other words, put somebody into housing and then surround them with services. Try again, and eventually it works. There's people I was convinced would die on the street who were able to get into housing first, and I don't see them anymore, not because they died, but because they now have a home, a place to live, a place to be safe. So housing is ultimately the answer, and I know the mayor agrees with me on this. And housing first, getting people off the streets as quickly as possible, and providing services so that they can become more stable will mean that a lot more people will take advantage of these kinds of services. I think you have to offer something that people believe in, and that's what we need to do.
You want to say anything to that?
I agree. We've seen this housing first model has worked really well in Utah. We're hoping to prove out another concept that can work. So housing first for some of the most complicated, most difficult people, we've seen housing first really help them to live measurably better lives, but also it's saving tax dollars. We're proving out a concept of rapid rehousing. Our thinking is that there are people who are maybe less complicated, certainly have complicated crisis, but less complicated. And so rapid rehousing is something where it wouldn't be permanent supportive housing, but we're going to give them housing vouchers to get them into housing for a period of time, and then we can scale back that voucher over time to where they're completely independent and self-reliant. And we've working with the University of Utah to do a randomized control trial to help us to evaluate whether this works or not. But we launched just a couple of months ago this rapid rehousing for single adults. And we're going to do that over the next 5 years with a randomized control trial.
I'm trying to get a sense of where your major disagreements are. I mean, it seems to me Glenn Bailey, the principal one, or one of them anyway, certainly the hard closure date for Road Home. You're very worried about that. And Mayor McAdams, you seem more optimistic that won't be as much of a problem. Glenn Bailey, is there anything else you disagree with in terms of this holistic approach the mayor's talked about?
Well, I guess it's not so much disagreement as I have a lot of concerns, which is one of the reasons why the hard closure date troubles me so much.
So that's really top of list for you.
Yeah, because I think we're really counting on a system that we haven't proven out yet. I mean, sure, elements of it have worked in different places, but we're really saying we're going to aggressively reduce the number of homeless people that need a bed at the same time when our economy continues to produce homeless folks and our overall population grows, which means a certain percentage of that growth is going to include people who are homeless. So I think saying that we can close an 1,100-bed shelter and replace it with 700 beds in 2 years' time is very optimistic, given a few factors. One, situation in Washington. A lot of the homeless services are supported by federal dollars. Those are very likely to decline and decline drastically.
In the Trump administration?
Under the Trump administration and what's going on with Congress right now. Also, I think we really, really need to preserve low-barrier shelter. And the new model is resource centers that are all in one. You'll have food service, you'll have day center, you'll have everything in one place. That could work extremely well for a lot of people and get them through the system faster. But I'm really afraid that there's a lot of people who will be left out of that system. It's also an extremely expensive model because now we're going to have three shelters that provide all of those services instead of a shelter and then a soup kitchen and a day center that are separate facilities. When you do that, especially when those shelters are smaller, you lose the economy of scale. That's a good thing if people get better service. But with declining resources, it's going to be really, really hard to sustain.
Hold on. I want to have the mayor deal with those before you move on to that. Start with that federal question, the concern that Glenn Bailey has and others about federal money.
Yeah, I think there's some uncertainty there, and that worries us. There's certainly some moving targets. I would say, I mean, there are those who are out there. There are those out there who think that if we if we, you know, what's the opposite? If we build it, they will come. If we deconstruct it, they will leave. I don't believe that, and I know that Glenn doesn't believe that. So I would say we don't differ in that regard. Where we differ maybe is I'm confident but optimistic, and Glenn needs to be conservative about this, and he sits in a different chair than I do.
Yeah.
Trenches. Yeah, in the trenches, and he's really going to see what happens if my optimism doesn't materialize. And so, and it's not just
optimism.
Does that
make you nervous, Mayor?
A little bit, and that's why I want Glenn to be there and to be an advocate for this, because he's an important voice in this conversation, and he needs to hold people like me accountable to this. You know, I say optimism. There's some confidence with that optimism.
Sure.
It's not just wild optimism, but he's an important voice in this conversation. I expect him to be kicking and screaming and yelling if the optimism doesn't develop.
Are you prepared? Forget federal money for a moment, yeah. Although that's still a part. Are you prepared to pay the costs? Glenn Bailey says it's expensive.
Yeah, I think so. And that's been some of our conversation with the legislature and what got me from a phased out Rio Grande to a hard closure date is people saying, stepping up and saying, we realize that this new model will cost more and we're willing to fund that cost. That we believe that in the long term, it's actually going to save us money. If you can get somebody stable and living on their own rather than perpetually in crisis, that'll have a long-term cost savings to the taxpayer. But it's going to, in the short term, be more expensive. And hearing people like the Speaker and State Department of Workforce Services say, we're willing to support this new model because we believe it'll work, helps me have some confidence.
I wonder, there's another economic, I want to ask you both about economic factor. I'm not sure how you can measure it. What about the aspect of gentrification going on in Salt Lake City right now? This is another economic factor that seems to me must be playing some kind of role in this. Glenn?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And I think it's true all over the country. I mean, a lot of people think that maybe we provide too good services, a lot of people will come here from elsewhere, except this crisis is happening in every major American city. Los Angeles and Honolulu have declared states of emergency over the homeless situation in those communities. And gentrification is happening all over the country, too. So what we're seeing is rising rents everywhere, and wages aren't going up, especially for people who don't have a lot of skills.
I would add one more thing to that of troubling trends.
Is an opioid
crisis, mm-hmm. and mental health crisis that is troubling. And so one of the things that we haven't talked about, because the conversation over the last week's been really about bricks and mortar and physical facilities, but is this treatment component. And I was just at the National Association of Counties in Washington, and the opioid session of that conference was packed. And it is around the country. We have this opioid addiction and crisis that's surrounding that. So one of the things that is yet to be talked about in greater detail, but probably will come out in the next week, is a greater focus on treatment. And it's not a secret. I'm not preempting any announcements here, but the state's willingness to step up and fund substantially treatment for individuals who were formerly incarcerated. We recognize that's expensive and not a great place to put them in a prison warehouse, but they need treatment. And so I do see the state coming to the table with a lot of funding to support treatment for these individuals.
So even plugging in all of Glenn Bailey's concerns, the ones that are even more abstract, harder to measure, gentrification, the sense of hopelessness, the possibility of federal, you're still confident that you're still confident to be behind a hard close date for a
load
home?
Yeah, I'm confident. And I think it's going to work. I think, you know, in my job, I was faced with the decision of, can we, you know, we got to make a deal. And sometimes it's the art of the deal. And I got to work with there's treatment dollars and there's shelter dollars and incredible resources on the table that I believe will make people's lives measurably better. And I want to work with that to do that. And some of, you know, a lot of this is within my control. If we can work to make this happen and make this a success. And so I have a high degree of confidence that it's going to work, that these facilities will, we will minimize the impact on surrounding neighborhoods, that we will see people's lives better, people connected to the services that are going to help their lives be measurably better. And I feel like, you know, or at least for the next few years, I'm going to have a role in making that hope a reality.
Glenn Bailey, you had at least one more thing, I imagine, on your list that you're worried about.
Yeah, there's like one more primary concern, and that is this notion of an overflow shelter. Because if we do have people on the street, particularly in the winter, but I think all year round, we're going to need a place to put them. Ideally, that would be a low barrier shelter downtown, which, of course, we already have. If that shelter was smaller and more manageable, I think it would function better, and we wouldn't be needing to look for another site. There's no overflow shelter in the legislation that's being proposed in the legislature.
But that isn't even in the works, is it? There's not even any it seems like
it's been discussed, but it isn't actually in the legislation. And I know Mayor McAdams has good intentions of making sure that that happens before the hard closure date of the road home. I think it's critical. I think it needs to be downtown. The chances of that are not very good. So we'll have people on the street downtown. And how does that overflow shelter function? Is it only available in the winter? Or if we have hundreds of people on the street with nowhere to go, are we going to be able to open that as needed? I think that's going to be a critical part of the discussion as we move forward.
We're running out of time. I want to give you a chance to respond to that. I mean, seems like there are some pretty powerful business interests who are not crazy about the idea, obviously, of a shelter, a low-barrier shelter downtown. We already had that, the Rio Grande. Yeah. You know, you can go down the litany of businesses that are concerned about all of that.
Well, I think Glenn's right that the existence of a low-barrier overflow shelter is critical to the success of this model. I talk about we're making resource centers that aren't one-size-fits-all. Anybody who comes through the front door, we're going to take. We want these to be places of healing, and we connect people to services. But you're going to have a place where people can go in a time of crisis. Because if
downtown,
I don't know about the location. I think that's still to be discussed. But I think if you're going to have, you got to have a low barrier overflow shelter, or you're going to have that winter snowstorm, and all of these shelters are going to have to start taking on everybody who comes in, and the whole model falls apart. So a need for a low barrier shelter is critical. Low barrier overflow shelter is critical to the success of the model.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that it's crucial because if our new shelters, our new resource centers are overwhelmed from the day they open, they won't get a chance to function as they're envisioned to function. And this whole thing falls apart. Capacity is key.
I agree.
You agree with that? I mean, the idea that if you start with just crazy, that they're not going to have a chance to get going.
Yep.
That's a big concern.
I think
Glenn
he's
Berry,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you finally, and Mayor, I'll just put this to you. There's a new siting process that's going to be going on now. You saw what Mayor Biskupski had to go through. I don't suppose you envy this new process.
You know, I think. I was elected
What lessons did you learn, I guess?
Sure. Well, I was elected to make tough decisions, yeah. And I'm not going to shy away from that. So what we're looking at is we want a process that involves many stakeholders. We're going to have the state at the table. We're going to have local leaders. We hope to have homeless service providers, others at the table to help to inform that decision. But my hope is that we can gather as much information. We're going to probably put out some potential sites of where we think it could go, gather as much information as we can on the front end, and then narrow down those sites or rank the order of those potential sites.
And you've learned for what may not have worked this time.
Yeah, I think so. I think you learn from the past, and I think we've got a process. I think that certainly there will be people out there with a NIMBY attitude, and I think that we're going to listen to concerns. If they have valid concerns about why a site is better or worse, we want to incorporate that. But, you know, certainly I'm hoping people will step forward and say we want to be part of the solution.
Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. Mayor, thank you for coming up. And Glenn Bailey, Executive Director of the Crossroads Urban Center, thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.